Thank God. Thank God. Doing okay, and I have tea now and everything. All right, let's get started. It is late. We are on Rav Hai Gaon. I thought we would finish Rav Hai Gaon today, but now I'm sort of wondering. But we'll see. We've talked about Rav Hai Gaon as the last of the major Gaonim, if not necessarily historically the final Gaon. Remember that he's born in the year 939. He passes away in the year 1038, 99 years. His father, Rav Shrira Gaon, we talked a lot about. He takes over from his father, Rav Shrira. He builds up the yeshiva in Sura in a big way. The yeshiva had really been deteriorating. And he does a lot to build it up. And the last thing that we had talked about was his role in our Mesorah in terms of his influence on Torah. He writes many things on many different areas. He writes on halacha, he writes on Gemara, he writes on Hebrew grammar, he writes poetry. He's quoted by everybody in every arena. I pointed that out. Commentaries on Tanakh quote him, halachic works quote him, Gemara quotes him. We talked about his students and how through him we get to Rabbeinu Gershom and Rashi and Tosfos and all of the early Ashkenazi authorities. And then on the other hand, he's also a Rebbe of Rabbeinu Chananel, you get from him the Rif and the Rambam and that whole world of Sfarad, not to mention the Spanish halachic authorities learn from the authors of the Tosfos. So Ramban, Ritva, Ra'ah, they're all getting from him as well. Rav Hai is a key link in all the chains. And we said that he makes major contributions to the way we approach learning Gemara. He explained a lot of Gemara, but between his Sfarim and in terms of his letters. But the last thing that I wanted to point out to you, and I think I started to mention it at the end last time, but that was 2 weeks ago, so who really remembers, is source number one. I thought this was really interesting. We said because his area of the Jewish world is in decline at that point in time, other centers are developing. And it's really, you know, a question of how you do cause and effect. Bye, Dazi.
I'm sending you a picture.
Okay. It was in the email.
Oh, it's in the email. Okay.
So it's a question of cause and effect. Do the other areas growing have an impact of diminishing Sura and Pumbedisa, or is it Sura and Pumbedisa are in decline and therefore the other areas grow? And the two really go together, and we'll talk more about that hopefully next time when we talk about the transition from the Gaonim. But in his lifetime, Jewry in Spain is starting to grow and becoming more of a thing than it had been before. And he gets this letter from them in which they ask him, you know, should we really be focusing on Gemara? Like, that was all well and good for you, where you are. That's the style of the Gaonim in their yeshivos. But where we are in Spain, it's a very philosophical world. Maybe we should spend more time on Machshava, on philosophy. Like, let's do that instead. He's not a fan, to say the least. If you take a look at the first source, and this is from the article that I've been referencing for the last couple of Shiurim, Rabbi Shmuel Mirsky's article, Rav Hai Gaon. And I'll just read out my English translation. You can see the original here as well. Those days were the period of the growth of the new Jewish center in Spain. In truth, this began back in the days of the Second Beis HaMikdash. There were Jews in Spain already then, and perhaps even earlier. But only at the end of the period of the Gaonim did it grow and become independent. This center was the first of the centers in the European diaspora. Until then, Jewish settlements were primarily in Asia and Africa. If you remember the map that we drew in the first week that we were talking about the Gaonim, you know, other than Rome and the Greek islands, which never became centers of the diaspora. Rome, even though there are Talmidei Chachamim there, Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma is there, Rabbi Yossi ben Trajon is there, like there are. Nonetheless, it doesn't become like the center to which all Jews flock, and I think, you know, with good reason.
On the whole.
So we're now in the 11th century.
11th.
Right, the end of the 10th, beginning of the 11th. And because the geographic, political, and financial conditions of the European center were different from those in Asia and Africa, this center faced a basic question. Should it also be built on the foundation stones of Babylonian Judaism, as this one had been built in its day, on the foundation stones which shifted and settled in Neherda, which is a phrase that comes from the Gemara. It talks about Torah and its movement to Neherda. There was a shul called Deshaf V'Yasif. That's the whole thing. The bottom line is he's borrowing a phrase from the Gemara. Or should it grow and develop according to its own conditions? Should the Talmud hold a place at the forefront of the education of the generation born in Spain, as in Babel, or should other studies inherit its place? These questions shook the lips of Rabbi Shmuel, the Nagid of Spanish Jewry, Shmuel HaNagid, who we're going to be talking about hopefully next. And this is the clear, he was the leader of the Jews in Spain. And this is the clear and powerful answer of Rav Hai, as a leader instructing him. He says, "And this that I instruct our master the Nagid, may he live forever, that your involvement should not be in philosophy, which is a hard trait, philosophy," he says, "and it brings sin. Our sages forbade it." He says, you're not supposed to be doing philosophy. "But your involvement should always be in Talmud and an analysis of lessons, pilpulim of Torah, as are involved those who are beloved and pleasant to us, the sons of Kirwan, the sons of the western lands, may they be blessed to heaven." He says in Kirwan, the yeshiva in Tunisia. In Eretz Yisrael, they learn Gemara. The whole, southern coast of the Mediterranean, that's what Jews do, that's what we do here, and that's what you should be doing in Spain. And the Gaon told the Nagid that this question also stood before the Babylonian Jews more than once. Don't think that this was a new question. We had the same question. "And that many confusions and conflicts and worthless things had followed it into the hearts of those of the East. When they started doing philosophy, all sorts of problems followed." Rav Hai Gaon is not a fan, as you can see, of learning Machshava. "And the Gaon also called upon God to testify about himself," about Rav Hai, "that he wrote this response out of great love and tried and pure friendship, and that through experience he knew that Talmud study would be appropriate for all souls. For scholars it would add wisdom, for the simple people it would provide spiritual preparation to receive the yoke of Torah and mitzvahs. Everyone should learn Gemara." That's his position. "Anyone who thought that another subject could replace it were only misled and misleading." Rav Hai was not known to equivocate. He wasn't somebody who said, "Well, I could see it this way, I could see it that way." Think of, like, we've learned enough to have some familiarity with at least the writing styles of Gaonim. Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Shrira Gaon, Rav Hai Gaon. They told you, this is the way it is. This is what we're doing. And, you can follow me, you cannot follow me, but this is what you should be doing. That was the way that he approached it.
Well, there's so many different reasons why we would think he would say no. First of all, maybe he could be right. Philosophy, you're getting into territory that's a little, controversial. It's shaking things up. You have, Hashem. There's a lot that's going on there. It's controversial. Mm-hmm. But also, now, Rav Hai Gaon is not going to be the center. It's maybe he... I don't want to say it in a negative way, but I'm just saying, now he's no longer going to be the guy.
So, it's an interesting thought, but I'm not sure how true that would end up being, because I think it's sort of the opposite, right? I hear the argument of, if they're not focused on halacha, why should they bother communicating as much with the yeshivos in Babel? But the problem is, they need someone to answer their questions. And if they get involved in Gemara and Halacha where they are in Spain, they can actually grow new authorities, which is what happens in the end. If they don't, then they're beholden forever to the yeshiva in Babel to answer their questions, because they don't have the experts.
But their questions are going to evolve and really be more based on where they are. So then they're going to start building people and authority that are in those places. He won't really be able to relate back to, Rav Hai won't be able to, but what's going on over there? It's different. They're becoming maybe more commercial and businessmen and stuff like that, whereas he is a little bit more back in the...
So, the commerce isn't the issue that they're concerned about. They want to know about learning philosophy. So let's say they become an academy that learns Jewish thought, right? So when they have a halachic question, what are they going to do? If your answer is they're not going to be so focused on halacha and they're not going to care, that's a much bigger issue than Rav Hai not being the center of their universe anymore. That is more of what he's afraid of. I think his concern, which comes through in the piece here that Rav Mirsky brings, is, number one, if you get involved in philosophy in this world at this time, it means you're involved with Muslim thought. Right? That's what the Rambam did. The Rambam is later than this, but it existed before him. Rav Sajagon was involved in that kind of thing. There's a feeling of you're going to get involved in outside things. That's number one. And number two, you will find then that the commitment to halacha atrophies. You need a level of familiarity in order to even know what a question is, in order to care about what a question is. I think those are the things that are really his concern. I think just the opposite in terms of, you know, the focus, he will be less of a focus the more they develop their own authorities. And he's prophetic in the sense that they needed to develop their own authorities. Because another 60 years after he passes away, you've got the Crusades. Writing away to Babel isn't an option. You need your own authorities, and that's part of how things develop. And the transition from the period of the Gaonim to the period of the Rishonim is based on that. The development of Ashkenaz and Sephard as different identities is based on that. So, yeah, I think the concern is really much more about the community's fealty to halacha and the fear of the more you get involved in philosophy, the more you're involved in a world that's going to take you away from your focus on Judaism. I think that's really where his concerns are. But he is a philosophical person. It's just that he's not into the whole, you know, Muslim school, Jewish school. Like, that's not his thing. Rav Mirzi actually goes on at length about that. I didn't go into it in terms of what I brought you here. But he has a philosophy. His philosophy essentially is, number one, very rational. He's not into invoking a lot of supernatural, as you'll see. And he's very pragmatic. He's not debating, you know, angels dancing on the head of a pin type stuff. He's very practical, very pragmatic about, you know, Jewish thought. I'm going to give you examples. You'll see what I mean. When it comes to free will, so somebody writes to him with a question. If God controls everything that happens, that means that if somebody murders somebody else, God forbid, they didn't really kill anybody because that person was going to die anyway. So why should you punish the murderer? Mm-hmm. Right? Person was going to die anyway. What's the difference? That was the question somebody sent him. It's a variation on the classic question. If God knows what's going to happen, then do you have free will and so on and so forth. So take a look at source number two. We get in the Otzer HaGaonim his answer to this question. He said, I'll read out my English translation, but you can see the Hebrew as well. He says, but the question will be, this is the person asking him, if someone is attacked by a murderer who kills him, if that wicked person had not killed him then, would you say he would have died anyway or remained alive? Right? What would have happened if the murderer hadn't done it? Answer, we don't know this. Only God knows. But we can assume that he would have died, even had he not killed him. Except for acts of heaven, he says sometimes, you know, God may choose to that something happened to somebody in a certain way. Also, one who is destroyed unjustly, which he does not explain, but he opens the door for the idea that one person may perform a violent act against somebody else that they didn't deserve and was not what God wanted, and it happens anyway. Which is an idea that we find later in Jewish thought, and it's a key part of the theodicy discussion, right? Bad things happening to good people and how did God allow it and so forth. There is this idea, which you see Rav Haigon mention as an aside, that, yeah, sometimes bad things happen and it wasn't just and it wasn't fair. People die in an earthquake and that's just... Why? Why did God create his world this way? That's a really good question. But the world is created this way. That's part of his answer, but he continues to say... The questioner asked, if you assume that the victim would have died at God's word had the murderer not killed him, which is, you know, what he's saying is true in the bulk of cases, then how can we say that the murderer took his life? And how could he have the judgment of a murderer? How can we punish him? Answer, the wicked person should not have done that to the victim, even if he would have died without this person killing him. This does not exempt him from saying about him that he did what he should not have done, and he deserves the judgment decreed upon him. He says, yes, it's true. Maybe the person would have died anyway. But it doesn't excuse you from killing somebody. You still can't do bad things to people. It's a very rational, pragmatic approach to things. Mm-hmm. There's no mysticism. There's no, you know, it was
philosophy,
his spirit of whatever.
Like, you know.
Yeah, he's addressing it, but in a very simple way.
Yes. Do you agree, Rabbi Tishner, that if someone studies too much philosophy, it brings them too far away from Judaism? And of course,
I think it can.
Me too.
I think it definitely can. I mean, I've seen it.
But why? I know I've also seen it, but I wonder why. Like, why can't it be reconciled?
Because people are not rational.
Yeah.
That's why people are not rational. People get influenced by all sorts of things. Avraham Lichtenstein has a great essay on this topic, where he talks about how the reality is that sometimes we are convinced by the majority of the population of something just because everybody says it, so it gives it weight. Sometimes it's because of the person who is presenting it. Someone is charismatic, somebody is attractive, whatever it is, and that biases us towards accepting what they have to say. Sometimes it's just the subtlety of the way they present it. He says, you know, sometimes you'll see in literature or entertainment or whatever, you'll see that they'll tell a story and, like, the religious person is painted as being very rigid and unsympathetic, you know? And then you naturally have a bias against that person in the story. There are all sorts of ways in which people come to conclusions that aren't rational. That's, you know, that's number one. So even if you have both ideas in front of you, they're not on an even playing field. But aside from that, people come up with different ideas, even when they have truth in front of them. There is a lot of gray, and there are a lot of ways in which people, William James, I've quoted this various times, and I don't think I've quoted it here, the philosopher and writer, William James said, the only thing you can count on philosophers for is to disagree with other philosophers. They're all looking at the same data, but they come to different conclusions. They have different bent. They have a different influence on them, and they come up with different ideas. You can't just assume, well, let them read Torah, let them read this, and don't worry, Torah is going to attract them. Not to mention, you know, Torah relies a lot on faith. I'm not a believer in the idea that you prove to people, you know, the existence of God and the existence of that. There will always be something that you can't prove. And the, then it's up to them. And if they're in an environment where they're, you know, debating against a much larger non-Jewish, non-observant majority, you know, it's easy for them to say, you know, I'm not so sure, maybe not. Especially because, depending on who they are, their stage in life, who they know, the cost of sticking to Judaism may be higher than the cost of, you know, leaving it. You know, that's something that we've seen. It's a reality.
I have a question. Like, is he referring to Jewish philosophy or philosophy in general?
So it's a good question, and I suspect there's no drawing a line between them. I think the idea of exploring philosophy necessitates that you look at all ideas and, you know, argue why this is true and this is not. When the Rambam writes his Mora Nevuchim, which again hadn't been done at this point, but when Rav Sadia Gaon writes his Emunas Vedeos, which did exist at this point, he brings in other ideas in order to disagree with them, but he's bringing them in. So there's no such thing as just studying Jewish philosophy. You know? I mean, you can, I suppose, just read a book that presents Jewish ideas. But even in the Gemara, when it presents ideas that aren't ours in order to disagree with them, but they're there. Yeah. Go ahead. I can see you holding back. Don't hold back.
Well, I just think that it's impossible to ignore the fact that there's so many different types of people in the world.
Yep.
And there are always going to be a certain type of people who constantly have questions. And it's not fair to say, you know, it's not worth you exploring your questions because they're going to ask them anyway.
Ah.
And, like, in my view, it's better to... Right. Like, being one of these people, I remember in high school being so frustrated with the lack of opportunity for me to, like, ask real questions.
Right.
And I actually remember that the school brought in someone from New York to speak.
he worked for like some sort of organization that was, it was like,
I let,
yeah.
The, you're right. And I think that he's not saying there should be no discussion of these issues. He's answering questions. We're going to see more of them that are about these issues. He's clearly thought about them. And he's willing to discuss them.
Right.
But he doesn't want it to be at the expense of Gemara and Halacha. He wants it to be in addition to Gemara and Halacha. I think that's
but
really
that's
the key
really
distinction.
Coming
well, it came through in his answer to Spain, right? When he said it, he didn't say to them, this is, you know, entirely off limits to you. But he said, you're right, it's true. He did say, it should not be in philosophy, which is a hard trait. It brings sin, and our sages forbade
yeah,
it.
I mean, I don't
it's
know.
True.
Like, I read that, and it's pretty clear.
Right. Maybe I'm biased by the fact that I'm also thinking about the way the Rambam approaches it, and the Rambam is definitely open to it. But the way the Rambam writes it is, you first have to anchor yourself in Gemara and Halacha, and once you know all of that, then you can explore these other things. Because you have your solid basis and your stability in Judaism.
I can appreciate that. That makes sense.
So I'm biased by that, and I'm sort of assuming, of course, Rav Hai would go along with that, because he does discuss philosophy. He thinks about it and he writes about it. But you're right. The source that we brought here is much stronger.
I also think, like, when you, I mean, with all respect to Rav Hai Gaon, obviously, you know, I think that reading... If you're the kind of person who can't help but have like angst and questions, and it's not, it doesn't mean you're not a believer. It just means that like, you know, there's a constant dialogue in your mind about things. You read something like this, and there's a certain shame that, you know, is cast upon you, which could make someone run in the opposite direction when really they would have needed someone to pull them close.
Right.
It's a very polarizing statement.
Yes.
Because you say to your, for me, like, this has not, like, put my faith, you know, in question.
Yeah.
But I'm strong enough. But, like, but let's say, you know, you're at a point in your life where you're really grappling with something, you read something like this, and I would say to myself, this religion isn't for me, because
right.
there's no space for someone like me.
Right. And the difference is, he's writing this letter to Shmuel HaNagid, the leader who's setting up the curriculum. When he was asked...
You don't think he thought it was going to be reread by us all these years later?
No, I don't. The same way that we learned about Rosajagon and we saw the researcher from, where was it, Japan, and the researcher from
right.
the Netherlands
right.
who were talking about his piyutim. The, I don't think he's thinking about it being read, you know, by random people. He wrote the letter to Shmuel HaNagid. We are, you know, effectively peeking at his correspondence.
I guess you ought to think about all the letters you write.
Yeah.
You never know who cares.
But when he does get a question, like this philosophical one, he doesn't say to the guy, stop thinking about those things.
Right.
He
right.
discusses and debates it. And we're going to see more. You're going to see. I have a whole bunch that I'm going to bring here. He does deal with it. So I think that supports the idea that it's not an intolerance for people's doubts and questions as much as it's where do you place your emphasis. But I definitely hear you, because you're right. The wording in that source with his letter to Shmuel and Agid is really strong. That is true. Another issue really related to free will. The Gemara talks about the concept of mazal. Right? Mazal. The idea that you are born under a certain constellation, planets are ascending, descending, whatever it is, and that affects who you're going to be. Right? A person is born under a certain sign, they are destined for bloodshed, and they can either become a moel or a shochet, or they can become a murderer, things like that. So he's asked about that. Does that mean that your identity is preset? So take a look at source number 3. The classic Gemara on this is the end of Masechah Shabbos, and that's what he is asked about. That which was written in Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's notebook, as the Gemara frames it. One who is born on a Sunday will be a man who does that, whatever. I skipped all of the specifics. When mazel causes heat to come at its time to these people, right? If your mazel is that you are going to be heated, like physically hot, one can drink cooling drinks to cool off, and his body won't be hot. In other words, mazel that dictates the weather is going to be hot doesn't mean that there's nothing you can do about it. Drink a cold drink. And for some people, from God, it is pleasing before Him, before God, to save this person. and to push away the one he wishes to push away. There are some people, for whatever reason, God wishes to help them, and some people God wishes to make things harder. And so regarding theft or immorality, desires for those things, whether for this group or that group, mazel only causes desire and appetite. Like a person whose mind thirsts and his spirit longs and his spirit is torn for that theft and or immorality, and he can overcome his desire and overpower it. It is like any yetzer hara. He says there is such a thing as a yetzer hara. There is such a thing as an influence on a person. And yes, he lives in a world that very much believes that astrology is a thing. It's science to them. And whatever, you know, sign you're born under or whatever it is can actually impact your life. Which, even though to us it sounds strange, in their world, literally this is science. In the same way that I believe in all sorts of forces that you can't see. Radio waves, gravity, like all sorts of things. You can't see it. But I believe I believe that the reason why there are tides is because the moon is drawing the water, you know, with its gravitic force. Tell them that 1,000 years ago, and they'll say, oh, so you do believe in astrology. Mm-hmm. Right? They would take that as confirmation.
I thought it's against the Torah. I thought it's like what the non-Jew believes.
So Ramban writes that astrology is real, and the reason we're not allowed to consult it is because it turns you away from relying on God. But he believed that it was effective. Not everybody agreed. If I remember correctly, I think it was the Rambam who did not think so, but not because he felt it was impossible, but because he felt it was wrong. The debate was not like it's heresy to believe that it actually has power. So he's writing in that context, and he says there are lots of things that influence a person's life, right? Your parents, your socioeconomic status, your neighbors, all sorts of things are going to influence you. This is one more influence. But it doesn't dictate who a person is going to be any more than any other influence. You have choices. You can make a decision. You know, Rav Dessler becomes famous for many reasons. But one of the things that he's most famous for is his philosophy of free will. He argues that free will is not this very broad power that we exert in every direction, in every sphere of our life. He says, most of your decisions are a function of decisions that were made before, whether by you or by people who made them for you effectively. Your free will is in a narrow area where you could really go this way, you could really go that way, and you make a decision. So, you know, to apply his argument in practice, if you have somebody who is raised by thieves, and he grows up with that as his morality, odds are he's going to become a thief. Not because he chose to, but because that's what they did, and that's what he learned, and that's what he assumes is normal. If you have somebody who is raised to, well, let's take one that people don't like discussing. You have someone who is raised to talk in shul. That's what they do. That's what their parents do. That's what they see. That's what everybody around them does. So he's not choosing to talk. This is what you do. It's not even exertion of free will. Free will comes in, and the same thing, by the way, for the good. Right? A person who is raised by plain, normal, moral people is not really tempted to steal something in a store. Mm-hmm. Right? Assuming everybody's healthy, they're not going to go in that route. It's not I'm a great person because I decided not to shoplift. This is a decision that was made for you. It's where you have things that you could really go either way on, that's where free will comes into play. And what Rav Haigon is arguing is this mazel is just another factor that you have to deal with, the same way you deal with all the other influences on you. But you can deal with it. It doesn't dictate who you are going to be. That's his position. Mm-hmm. Again, weighing in on a philosophical issue and not yelling at the person, stop thinking about mazel, you know, do your mitzvahs, eat your broccoli. He says, no, I'll discuss with you. This is the nature of it and this is what it means. And here's my pragmatic statement of how you should proceed.
We wish people mazel tov.
Yes, we do. I know someone who doesn't say mazel tov because he thinks that, yeah, and whatever. He's, yeah. But yeah.
Interesting. What are they saying?
I forget. He has something else that he says. I forget what it is. Yeah. Okay. When it comes to Agada, passages that are found in Medrash, that are found in Gemara, that are not halachic passages, that sometimes say things that are just really hard to accept from a philosophical perspective. So examples that we're going to see are passages of Gemara that seem like they must be an exaggeration, or passages that seem like that can't be real. That's got to be like a metaphor for something, or a passage that describes God in like God crying or laughing or something like that. Things that don't seem to fit our understanding of who God is. So he's very good with saying, don't take them literally. It's not meant to be taken literally. It's meant to be examined and understood in terms of its message, not in terms of the specifics. So I'll give you one example, and then we'll switch over to Parsha. If you take a look at source number four, another tshuva, another responsum of his. It is number four, sorry. It's also Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. I got confused. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah has Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi say the following. All of the creations of Bereshis were formed in their height, intellect, and tzivyon. That's the language of the Gemara. When the Pasuk says, Vayichulu Hashemayim v'aretz v'chol tziva'am, that everything was completed. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says that the things that God creates in Bereshis are not created in their infant form. They're created fully grown, right? It's one of the classic answers to the question of why it looks like the world evolved. If you believe that the world's only 6,000 years old. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the classic answers, and frankly one of the more compelling ones, is because God didn't need to create the world as a fledgling world and let everything proceed for billions of years. There was no point. So what did God do? He created the world looking like it would look if it was a fully formed world. This is what a fully formed world looks like. There are fossils. There are this. There are this. This is what if you ask a kid, make a diorama, whatever, they'll put in a whole bunch of things that didn't grow from nothing to that point. They put in a tree. The diorama didn't exist long enough for that tree to grow. Thank you. This is what it's supposed to look like. This is what the world is supposed to look like. That's that Gemara. But he says that each thing that was created was in its height, intellect, and tzivyon. So somebody commented on that Gemara, a Gaon, and the commentator said the following. A Gaon explained that God said to each creation, how would you like me to create you? That's the idea. They have a tzivyon. The word tzivyon means will. So God said, what do you want to be like? And each one replied, like this. And he created it according to its will. It's tzivyon. So did all of them have substance before they were created, such that they had a tzivyon? I don't understand what that means. What was a chicken before God created it? Or an egg, depending on which one's created first. Right? This view, the Gemara, is that the chicken is first. But what was the... Not both. The chicken. It's the chicken. So... According to this, does that mean that chickens existed in some form and God could consult them and ask them, what do you want to be? And then God brought them into existence. So he says, the explanation you found, this thing that you're asking me about, we don't know it and we don't agree. The question you asked is valid.
Why? A fully created world would have both.
No, the question of, I'm not doing chicken and egg thing now. I want to get the parsha. But he says, the question you asked is valid. Some have explained, according to philosophy, that the types of creatures have mishalim, and an image, there's some kind of a form of it that exists, kind of a Greek idea, separate from the physical thing, like the minting of a coin with divine wisdom. But these are remote statements themselves. They're far from the words of our masters, the sages of Israel, to call these mishalot, sivyo. No, he says, nah, all of these are empty words. Don't bother. It doesn't mean that God consulted the chicken and asked it, what do you want to look like? That's not what the Gemara means. That's not what it's saying. So, just ignore what that person said because it's illogical. Mm-hmm. And that's his approach. He dismisses that which he says is not logical. All right. We have more to see, God willing, next week. We'll, I don't want to cut him out. There's so much there that's a lot of fun in what Vaigon has to say. And then after him, we'll talk about the bridge from the Gaonim to the Rishonim, which is what comes next. Okay?
Thank you.